Hello, this is Trina Arpin. Welcome to the latest edition of the Cell Podcast. Today we'll learn how the neurons in our brains that sense food might control complex behaviors other than finding your next meal. Later, we'll learn about actionable strategies for advancing women in STEM fields. These stories and more are just ahead, so please stay with us. Cell celebrates all things sumptuous in their March 26th special review issue on the biology of food. Research into food comes in multiple flavors, from the seemingly simple decisions of what and when to eat, to broader issues of nutritional status, diet, and disease. In commemorating this issue, editor Sri Narasimhan chats with Marcelo Dietrich of Yale University on how food-sensing neurons in the brain may regulate more complex behaviors than hunger alone.
Hello, I'm Sri Narasimhan, scientific editor at Cell. Food, glorious food. The entire experience of a good meal. The taste, the texture, how appealing it looks, the smell, is clearly a sum of many parts. And of course, food, or the lack of it, can make us immensely happy or cranky. We know that the feeling of hunger or satiety involves signals from the brain. But new research in Cell suggests that there are far more layers to how food-sensing neurons in the brain actually control our behavior. To learn more about this, I'm speaking today with Marcelo Dietrich of Yale University. Thank you for joining us today, Marcelo.
Thank you for the invitation.
Could you tell us in a broad sense what your paper tells us about food sensing in the brain and behavior?
We show that the primitive areas in the brain that were thought to control basically homeostatic functions, for instance, food intake, they can also regulate more complex behaviors that we show repetitive stereotypic behaviors in mice. We were able to activate neurons in the hypothalamus that promote hunger. These neurons are called AGRP. And then we could test these animals in different behaviors. The first thing that we did was test them in the typical home cage and scan with the software all kinds of behaviors these animals were doing and comparing what kind of behavior they were doing in the presence of food or in the absence of food. Then we went to test in different tests out of the home cage. So we used some classic behavior tests in mice like plus maze, zero maze to test anxiety, open field. And we found that these animals actually, they have a decreased anxiety-related behavior, which also goes in line with the fact that it modulates the appetitive response. So they go to forage to find food. So being less anxious would be positive in that aspect. But when we test the animals in other tests, for example, a marble burrowing test, if the animals that develop more repetitive behaviors, we know that they have a tendency to bury more marbles. We found a very dramatic effect of the activation of these neurons. And we did a series of tests, for instance, place preference tests to see if they would pursue burrowing marbles instead of doing something else or exploring an empty arena, and they do. So it's a goal-oriented behavior that's driven by these neurons in the hypothalamus.
So what do we know about food and behaviors in humans?
We know quite a lot about the hedonic aspects of food intake in humans and brain imaging and things like that. In terms of the other side of the coin, how like the absence of food perhaps can drive complex behaviors, we know little. There are several reports that sort of got lost with the years in the history, I would say in the last 100 years, so you have anecdotal reports here and there, showing that actually people in different states where they were food deprived, they have very dramatic changes in behavior and in cognition. So actually those studies were sort of, I would say 10 years ago when I started studying this, were sort of the guides for this idea that actually there's a dramatic impact on behavior that's not well understood, is not well studied, and we don't know exactly this connection.
So I was wondering if we could digress a little bit and if you could give me your thoughts on this related paper from Zachary Knight and colleagues who are actually looking at these very neurons, the AGRP neurons.
It's a great paper, it's a very important work in the field. And I think the two papers from Zach's lab at UCSF and ours, they do synergize. In their paper, they show they record calcium transients in these neurons during natural behavior, and they found that actually these neurons are AGRP neurons, these hunger-promoted neurons, are dramatically inhibited by the sensory presentation of food. And I think this goes in line with our paper in one very important aspect of health, that eating disorders. In anorexia nervosa, for instance, you have these patients that we don't know why they develop these behaviors, but they do engage in some repetitive response, including repetitive exercise, and they lose weight, and some of them, they do even report hunger, but they just don't eat, indicating that there's a sensory disruption, the connection between the sensory perception of the world of food and actually the brain. And I think that's what our papers show in the behavior aspect and what Zach's papers show in the recording the activity of these neurons, showing that these neurons receive a very important input from sensory areas in the brain that we don't know. And I think it's a great area, it's a great time for us because it opens a lot of possibilities to study in the next few years.
Briefly, what do you think are some of the directions that you'd like to go ahead with in terms of future research?
My lab, particularly, I'm trained as a behavior neuroscientist and biochemistry, so we are pretty much interested in continuing this work on behavior and try to pursue a little further and how perhaps this hypothalamic circuit can change decision-making. And since these neurons, as Zach's paper suggests, integrate both interoceptive, so hormonal and nutrients coming from the peripheral tissues and sensory inputs, we are interested trying to dissect this connection to behavior, to decision-making. Basically, like William James would say like 100-some years ago in psychology, the emotions, they arise from peripheral sensations. And basically, that's sort of our line of research, trying to see how our body is all connected to drive behavior in an environment that's dynamic, that's changed, and we have to adapt.
Excellent. I wish you all the very best in pursuing these questions.
I just want to thank you, Sel, for the interest in our work again, and thank you the people in my lab and also Tamás Horváth, who collaborate in this work.
For these exciting papers and other science, check out our website at www.cell.com/cell. I'm Sri Narasimhan, scientific editor at Cell.
Thanks, Sri and Marcelo. The report by Marcelo Dietrich and colleagues is available online at www.cell.com/cell. Coming up next, 7 steps to help women in science. Increasing women's participation in the STEM fields of science, technology, engineering, and math at all levels is an important goal. According to the National Science Foundation, women have earned about half of all science and engineering bachelor degrees since the 1990s. But account for just 28% of those working in these fields. Editor Sheila Chari talks with Susan Solomon about a new report that outlines some concrete steps that can get us there.
Hi, I'm Sheila Chari from Cell Stem Cell. Today, we'll be talking with New York Stem Cell Foundation CEO Susan Solomon about strategies for advancing women in science and engineering. The number of women embarking on scientific careers has been increasing in recent years, but we still haven't reached gender equality in the so-called STEM fields. The New York Stem Cell Foundation, through its initiative on women in science and engineering, is committed to making sure that progress is made. The group recently published their recommendations for advancing women in science in Cell Stem Cell. Susan is joining us now to talk more about this important issue. Hi, Susan. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'd like to start off with asking you to tell us about the challenges that women face in the current research environment and what prompted you to get NICEF involved.
Sure. I think it's interesting because women are quite visible in sciences, engineering, and technology and medicine. But if you actually drill down and you look at the number of women in particular aspects of the field and who is succeeding in leadership roles, it really gets pretty thin. And we wanted to understand why. We always want to be as good as we possibly can be in any of our own programs at NICEF. And so, you know, we took a look at how we were doing and we thought, well, it's okay, but it really could be better. And it's the kind of thing that here we have an organization founded and led by a woman. We've got gender balance throughout our organization in terms of staffing. But still, we realized that unless you actually are paying attention, your numbers can slip. You really have to attack this from all different fronts. And I think training seminars, workshops, discussions, anything that is going to keep this topic front and center is really critical. gender equality is something that affects all of us. And so what I wanted to do when we did this was to make sure we had a wide range of views represented, from early career, so we had some number of very early career people involved with us, and then the most senior people, leaders in their field, both men and women. And I wanted to try to come up with very, very specific steps. This is a field that has been researched endlessly, and there are extensive white papers. But as a colleague said to me before agreeing to participate, I just don't want to participate in another white paper exercise. And I said, well, I don't either. So let's see if we can come up with actionable steps. Let's see if most of them are the kinds of things that can be done without requiring funds, because I wanted to reduce the barrier to actually adopting the scorecard. And then it was suggested that NYSIF use its convening power and its communications platform to actually publicize those institutions and organizations who have decided to make this a priority. And so we felt that was a really wonderful way to both celebrate people who were engaging in the kinds of activities and thought process that is going to ultimately bring about this change, and also make it easy for them. So, yes, it does cost money to provide some extra support, an extra pair of hands, or childcare, but it really doesn't cost any money to have an implicit bias statement at the beginning of a search process, a jury selection process, etc. So it's really a mix.
You've told us a bit about the direct financial support strategies and the psychological and cultural strategies that you put forth. I'm wondering if you could also tell us a bit about the institutional report card.
The institutional report card, which we're really excited about, and the idea is if we could put together very, very specific requirements that we could ask funders, which we thought was really the best strategy, funders to require. So, for example, what proportion of a particular department's undergrads are female? What proportion of their postdoc population is female? What proportion of a particular faculty department? And then, over a period of time, we chose 5 years, what proportion of a department's tenured faculty members that were outside recruits were female, and then what proportion of a department's first-time tenure-track faculty member that were recruited from outside an institution were female. And then we, of course, asked questions about what is the institutional policies regarding paid family leave, the so-called pausing the tenure clock without penalty, what kind of additional support, and then what is the institutional policies regarding both female representation on internal committees and then specific committees such as appointments, promotions, finance, award, and strategy, because those really are where the dollars are spent, and that also is where we feel we can have the most impact on an institution if we have women on those key committees. And then finally, visibility. So we ask a question about how many in the last 12 months have of your speakers in your external seminar program are female. And so they're very straightforward, and it's something that we believe is quite manageable for institutions. We did not want to make it a 60-page scorecard that inevitably a woman would be tasked to fill out. We wanted to make it very straightforward, easy to understand, and something that was transparent enough to be able to publicize on our website and disseminate, so that we could reward those institutions and funders, many of whom are, I have to say that support for this is enormous, who either are doing this or think they're doing it, and now are able to have some tools to really take a look and say, okay, we think we're good, let's see how our policies are really translating. And then they can understand where they need to take action.
Thinking ahead, what are your plans for the working group in the future?
Well, we're very excited. The next iteration of this, actually, is to take a look beyond academia and see what's happening in the commercial world, in particular the corporate boardroom, where many of, really all of the companies come from, certainly in biotech, or, you know, in 99% of the cases, they're spun out from academic institutions. And we began to take a look at that, and actually Nancy Hopkins at MIT has done some extraordinary work in this area. And we have taken a look, and it's pretty shocking. You'll see, even in an institution, you know, which has done a lot of work in gender equality, all of a sudden you find that colleagues have, you know, when they're forming their companies and they're putting together their boards, either their founding boards or their scientific advisory boards, all of a sudden their female colleagues are nowhere to be found. And so this is a conversation that, again, I'm very, very big fan of Google's unconscious bias term and their approach to the program. I think it really is awareness. I mean, we see it, it's awareness and it's numbers. So we have to keep working on it, and that will be the next focus.
Finally, the strategies you've come up with are aimed at generating institutional change, and I'm wondering if you have any recommendations for individuals that like to be involved in promoting women in science.
I can't give individual career advice for it because it's so varied, people's situations. But make sure that your organization or the senior people in your organization have some kind of an initiative, or if they don't, some kind of an awareness. Hopefully this paper can provide a good beginning of a conversation if it's an organization that either hasn't been thinking about this because they've been sort of under a rock, or because in the case of startups, they're just moving so quickly that, you know, it hasn't made it onto the agenda.
Thank you, Susan, for sharing your insights with us today. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm excited about the time ahead. We have tremendous enthusiasm, both men and women, who want to carry this forward. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sheila and Susan. The report on the New York Stem Cell Foundation's recommendations is available online at www.cell.com/cellstemcell. Next, stay tuned for a roundup of this month's highlights from all the journals at Cell Press.
Hello. This is Eric Robbins, with additional news from around Cell Press this month. First up, according to research published in Cell Host and Microbe, a flu outbreak in India that has claimed over 1,200 lives may not be identical to the 2009 North American strain. A comparative analysis conducted by scientists at MIT shows that the flu virus in India seems to have acquired mutations that could spread more readily and therefore requires deeper studies. The researchers call on officials to increase surveillance of this and future flu outbreaks, and rethink vaccination strategies to account for potential new viruses. Next, a new study published in Cell Reports shows that tetracycline antibiotics, which are widely used, have unexpected consequences on the development of a variety of organisms and have a significant effect on cell mitochondria. Scientists have observed these effects at concentrations similar to those found in the soils in which food crops are grown, and the report calls for caution when using this family of antibiotics. Finally, a perspective piece in Trends in Biotechnology argues that gastrointestinal gases could be used as biomarkers for one's state of health. The authors suggest two novel gas sensing systems, including an electronic gas sensor in the form of a pill you can swallow that may offer a reliable and economical way to understand the impact of intestinal gases on human health, paving the way for the development of new diagnostic techniques and therapies.
This brings us to the end of this month's podcast. Thanks for joining us. You can listen to this and previous Cell podcasts at our archives or by using iTunes. And be sure to come back next month for more great science from around Cell Press.